Chapter 19 of the autobiography of Rudolf Steiner, entitled Chapters in the Course of My Life, 1861 to 1907. I spent very enjoyable hours of my life at the house of Marie Eugenie Della Grazzi. She received visitors every Saturday evening. People with the most varied spiritual views went there. The poet was at the center. She read from her poems and spoke in the spirit of her worldview with assured emphasis, and she illuminated life with those ideas. It was not the illumination of the sun. Indeed, it was always somber moonlight with threatening overcast skies. But in that dusky gloom, flames arose from human hopes, carrying high the passions and illusions that consume humanity. Yet all this was also humanly touching, always enthralling, and the bitterness was softened by the noble magic of a truly inspired personality. Lawrence Mühlner, a Catholic priest, had been Della Grazzi's teacher and was now a noble and helpful friend. He was also a professor of Christian philosophy in the theological faculty of the university. His countenance and his whole bearing displayed spiritual development through ascetic living. His outlook was skeptical, and he was thoroughly versed in philosophy, art, and literature. He wrote stimulating articles on art and literature for the Catholic daily paper Vaterland, and everything he said was permeated by the same pessimistic view of life and the world as that of the poet. Both had a vehement antipathy toward Goethe. Their interest turned more toward Shakespeare and the more recent writers born out of the life's pain and sorrow, or the naturalistic aberrations in human nature. They loved Dostoevsky. They loved Leopold von Sacher Masoch, whom they considered a brilliant writer, starkly truthful in his presentation of devastating human weaknesses thriving in the swamp of modern life. Lawrence Mühlner's dislike of Goethe was colored by Catholic theology. He praised Baumgarten's monograph on Goethe, which depicted the latter as a counterimage of all that is worthy of human striving. Della Grazzi was more a deep personal antipathy. Around them gathered professors of the theological faculty, all Catholic priests of the finest scholarship. Invariably, the most stimulating of them was the priest of the Cistercian Order of the Holy Cross, Wilhelm Neumann. Mühlner rightly respected him for his encompassing scholarship. Once, when in Neumann's absence I spoke with great admiration of his comprehensive knowledge, Mühlner said, quote, "Yes, Professor Neumann knows the whole world, plus three villages." Unquote. I liked accompanying that learned scholar when, after a visit, we left Della Grazzi. Consequently, I had many talks with this ideal learned person, who was also a true son of his church. I would like to mention here just two instances. One concerned the being of Christ. I expressed my view that Jesus of Nazareth, through an extra-earthly influence, received the Christ into himself, and that Christ, as a spiritual being, lives with human evolution since the mystery of Golgotha. This conversation remains deeply engraved in my soul. It was deeply significant to me and has often surfaced in my memory. The conversation really took place between three individuals, Professor Neumann, me, and an invisible third, the personification of Catholic dogmatism, who appeared to the spiritual eye behind Neumann. It accompanied him reprovingly, tapping his shoulder whenever the scholar's subtle logic led him to agree with me too much. It was remarkable how often the second half of what he was saying would be directly the opposite of the first half. I was face to face with Catholicism as expressed in one of its finest representatives. Through him I learned to respect it, but also to thoroughly recognize it for what it is. On another occasion we talked about repeated earthly lives. The professor listened and spoke of all kinds of literature that discusses this subject. He quietly shook his head several times, but seemed to have no intention of going into the details of what to him seemed a strange topic. Nevertheless, this conversation also became important for me. Neumann's discomfort at not expressing his opinions about my statements has remained deeply inscribed in my memory. At that time, the visitors on Saturdays included church historians and theologians. Occasionally one could meet the philosopher Adolf Stör, Maria Goswein von Berlepsch, the sensitive storyteller Emily Mataya, whose pen name was Emile Marriott, the poet and writer Fritz Lehmermeier, and the composer Alfred Strauss. I first met Fritz Lehmermeier, who later became a close friend, at De la Grazie's afternoon gatherings. An unusual man, he spoke of his interests with an inner measured dignity. He looked like the musician Rubinstein. He also resembled the actor Lewinsky. He worshipped Hebbel almost as a god. He had very definite views about art and life, which arose from an intelligent, knowing heart. He had written a profound and interesting novel, The Alchemist, and much of his work possessed great beauty and depth. He could also endow the simplest things in life with importance. I remember when I visited him with other friends in his charming little room in a side street of Vienna. He had just prepared his meal, 2 soft-boiled eggs with bread. While the water was boiling to cook eggs for us, he said emphatically, "This will be delicious." I will say more about him later. The composer, Alfred Strauss, was somewhat of a genius, but his disposition was deeply melancholic. When he played his etudes at Della Grazie's, one felt that the music of Anton Bruckner evaporated in these tones, seeking escape from earthly existence. Strauss was not well understood, but Fritz Lehmermeier's admiration for him knew no bounds. Lehmermeier and Strauss were both close friends of Robert Haemmerling. Later I was able, through him, to exchange a few letters with Haemmerling, of whom I shall speak later. Strauss's spirit clouded, and his life ended in serious mental illness. The sculptor Hans Brandstetter was also a visitor at Della Grazie's. Also, Werner, a historian of theology, often seemed invisibly present at those gatherings. He was addressed, so to speak, with hymn-like praise and wonderful descriptions of him. Della Grazie loved him above all others. He never came while I attended the Saturday gatherings, but his admirer, Della Grazie, presented us with a picture of that biographer of Thomas Aquinas from continually renewed aspects. She portrayed a kind, lovable scholar who remained ingenuous even into very old age. The image she so vividly invoked for us was of a man so utterly selfless and devoted to his subject that one could not help wishing there were more historians like him. There was something almost magical about these Saturday gatherings. After dark, the red shade of the ceiling lamp spread a festive light over everyone, and particularly when the less close acquaintances had gone, Della Grazie would have much to say, much that sounded like sighs, echoing the experience of bygone days of tragic fate. But much of a humorous nature was also expressed, concerning life's folly and tones of indignation over corruption in the press and elsewhere. Mixed with this was Müllner's sarcastic, often caustic, remarks about all kinds of philosophy, art, and other topics. Della Grazie's house was a place where pessimism revealed itself with the direct force of life. It was a place of anti-Goetheanism. When I spoke of Goethe, they listened, but Lorenz Müllner thought that what I attributed to Goethe had fundamentally very little to do with the actual minister of Grand Duke Karl August. Nevertheless, for me, every visit to this home, where I knew I was welcome, was immensely fruitful. I truly benefited from the cultural atmosphere. Agreement in ideas was not at all necessary for me, but rather human beings, whose efforts were genuine and receptive to the spirit. I was now divided between this house, which I so much liked to visit, and my teacher and fatherly friend Carl Julius Schröer, who, after the first visit, never again appeared at Della Grazie's. My feelings were torn. I was drawn in both directions by sincere love and esteem. However, it was at just that time that the initial ideas began to mature for my intuitive thinking as a spiritual path, a philosophy of freedom. That's the title. The article sent to Della Grazie, quote, "Nature and Our Ideals," contains the germinal idea for that book in this passage, long quote. Our ideals are no longer so shallow that they are satisfied by the all too frequently superficial and empty external reality. Nevertheless, I cannot believe that it is impossible to rise above the deep pessimism this insight can bring. And I find the means to rise above it when I look into our inner world, that is, when I approach the actual nature of our world of ideas. It is a sphere enclosed and complete in itself. It neither gains nor loses through the transient nature of external phenomena. Are not our ideals, when they are truly living individualities, entities in their own right, and independent of the favors or disfavors of external nature? If the lovely rose is shattered by heartless gusts of wind, it has fulfilled its mission, nevertheless, because it has delighted hundreds of human eyes. If tomorrow it pleases murderous nature to destroy the whole starry sky, nevertheless, for thousands of years people have reverently looked up to the stars, and that is enough. It is not their temporal existence, but their inner being that makes things perfect and complete. Our ideals are a world of their own, with a life of their own, that gains nothing through the cooperation of a well-disposed nature. What pitiable creatures human beings would be if they were unable to find fulfillment within their own world of ideals, but instead needed help from outer nature. Where would our divine freedom exist if external nature nursed and protected us and led us by the hand like helpless children? No, external nature must deny us everything so that the happiness we achieve is fully the product of our own free self. May nature daily destroy what we have built up, so that daily we may rejoice in creating anew. We wish to owe nature nothing, but ourselves everything. One might say that such freedom is merely a dream. While believing ourselves to be independent, we simply obey the iron necessity of natural laws. Our noblest thoughts are merely the result of nature working blindly within us. Oh, we must finally admit that a being who has attained self-knowledge cannot be unfree. We see the web of laws ruling over phenomena, and it gives rise to necessity. But in our cognition, we have the power to detach those laws from nature. And despite that, we are supposed to be involuntary slaves of nature's laws. End quote. I did not expand these thoughts in the spirit of controversy. I was impelled to present what my spiritual perception revealed, to confront a worldview that I saw as the very opposite of my own. Nevertheless, I respected this opposing view immensely, because I recognized it as the conviction of truly striving souls. The end of chapter 19. Chapter 20. During the period when I received so much that was stimulating at Della Grazie's, I also frequented a circle of young Austrian poets. We met each week for discussion and to share the work of one or another. A wide variety of people came to those gatherings. Every view of life and every frame of mind was represented, from the most naive optimism to the darkest pessimism. Fritz Lemmermeier was the soul of that circle. There one could feel the storm raging against the culturally obsolete. It started, quote, across the border, unquote, in Germany, unleashed by, among others, the Hart brothers and Karl Henkel. However, here it was saturated with the amiability of the Austrians. Much was said about it being time for a new wind to blow through every sphere of life, but expressed with the Austrian typical aversion to radicalism. One of the youngest of this circle was Josef Kitter. Stimulated by Martin Greif, he aspired to a certain form of lyric. He tried to avoid any expression of subjective feelings by presenting an event or situation objectively, as though observed not by the senses but by the feelings. He did not, for example, want to say that he was delighted, but would describe the delightful event vividly. Delight would then arise in the listener or reader without being expressed overtly by the poet. Kitter produced very beautiful things in this way. He was a naive person. He attached himself rather closely to me for a short while. Within the circle, I heard a German-Austrian poet discussed with great enthusiasm, and I read some of his poems. They impressed me deeply, and I endeavored to meet him. Fritz Lemmermeier knew him well, so I asked him, as well as a few others, whether the poet could be invited to our gatherings. I was told that wild horses could not drag him there. It seemed that he was an odd recluse, but I was very eager to meet him. One evening the whole company went strolling toward the place where those, quote, in the know, unquote, could find him. It turned out to be a little wine bar in the lane parallel to the Kärntnerstrasse. He sat in a corner with a sizable glass of red wine. He sat as though he had always sat there, and would sit there forever. He was very elderly, but had youthful, sparkling eyes in an expressive face, whose delicate features revealed a poet and idealist. He had not seen us enter. One could see in that noble head a poem taking shape. Fritz Lemmermeier had to touch his arm. He turned to look at us. He had been disturbed, and his surprised look could not conceal that. Nevertheless, he was charming about it. We gathered round him, though there were not enough seats for so many in the narrow room. It was remarkable how, after a short while, this odd recluse became talkative and spirited. We all felt that because of what was going on between our souls in this conversation, we could not remain in the stifling little room. It did not take much to persuade him to come with us to another place. We were all young, except for him and his friend who had belonged to our circle for some time, but it was soon evident that we had never been so young as on that evening with the old gentleman in our midst, for he was really the youngest of all. I was deeply touched by the magic of this personality. It was immediately clear to me that he must have produced works far more significant than those he had published, and I boldly asked him about it. He answered almost shyly, quote, "Yes, at home I have a few, quote-unquote, cosmic things," unquote. I managed to make him promise to bring these along the next time we could see him. This is how I came to know Ferger von Steinwand, a vigorous, inventive, and idealistic poet from Carinthia. He was the son of a poor folk and had suffered great hardship in his youth. The distinguished anatomist Hertel had come to appreciate him and provided for his needs so that he was able to lead a life of creative writing, thinking, and musing. For a long time the world knew little of him. Robert Haemmerling praised him highly after his first publication, Countess Seelenbrand. We never again had to go get the recluse. He came almost regularly to our evenings. One day, to my great pleasure, he brought his quote-unquote cosmic things. These were the title Chorus of Archetypal Impulses and the title Chorus of Archetypal Dreams. They are poems whose inspired rhythm reveal feelings capable of approaching the creative forces of the world. Substantial ideals were woven in sublime harmony, working as images of the cosmic seed forces. I view it as one of the important events in my youth that I was privileged to know Ferger von Steinwand. His personality had the effect of a sage who reveals his wisdom in pure poetry. I had been wrestling with the question of the human being's repeated earthly lives. Many aspects of this problem became clearer to me through my close relationship with those whose life habits and personal characteristics showed clear traces of individual traits that could not be explained by heredity or by experiences since birth. In Ferger's case, his facial expressions and every gesture revealed to me a soul being who could only have been molded at the time of Greek paganism and its influence on the development of Christianity at the beginning of the Christian era. Such insight cannot be gained by contemplating a person's immediately obvious expressions, but arise through a study of the traits that seem to accompany such expressions, and in fact deepen endlessly through intuition. Nor is it useful to try to gain such insight while with that person. Once a strong impression reverberates and becomes like a vivid memory, what is ordinarily considered significant dissolves, and what seems insignificant begins to speak a clear language. One who observes others just to figure out their previous earthly lives will never reach this goal. Indeed, one must experience this as an offense against the one being observed. Only then can one hope to see the long-ago events of a person's previous life within the present, coming, as it were, from distant spiritual realms, as if by destiny. During that same time, through spiritual perception, I gained a definite understanding of repeated earthly lives. I certainly had this insight before then, but in broader outlines, not as clearly defined impressions. I did not construct theories about things such as repeated earthly lives. I accepted it as self-evident when I encountered it in literature or otherwise. But I did not theorize about it, because I was conscious of a direct understanding of this realm that made possible my conversation with Professor Newman, referred to earlier. People who convince themselves about the reality of repeated earthly lives and the like can certainly not be blamed, although direct knowledge of these facts can be attained only along suprasensory paths. A perfectly valid conviction can be reached by healthy, unbiased reason, even without spiritual perception. It was simply that theorizing was not my path in this area. Also during this time, as my spiritual perception of repeated earthly lives was becoming increasingly defined, I was introduced to the Theosophical movement, which arose from H.P. Blavatsky. A friend I had spoken to about such things sent me Sinnett's title Esoteric Buddhism. This was the first time I encountered from the Theosophical movement. and it left me. Let me read that again. This was the first book I encountered from the Theosophical movement, and it left me with absolutely no impression. I was glad that I had not read it before I attained perceptions from my own soul life. I was repelled by its content, and my antipathy to such a presentation of the supersensory might have prevented me in the first place from pursuing the path outlined for me. The end of chapter 20. Chapter 21. At this time in my life, about 1888, I was motivated through my inner soul life, on the one hand, toward strong spiritual concentration, while on the other, life placed me within an extensive social life. I was editing the second volume of Goethe's scientific writings, and the detailed introduction I intended to write made it necessary that I present my view of the spiritual world in clear thoughts. To do this, I needed inner separation from all that I was connected with in the outer life around me. I owe much to the circumstances that made this possible. In those days I could sit in a cafe with its noisy life all around me, and yet be quiet inwardly with my thoughts concentrated on writing the first draft of what would eventually become that introduction. Thus I led an inner life that had no relationship to the outer world, whereas my interests were strongly connected to that world. This was also a time when my interest necessarily turned toward the crisis conditions becoming increasingly prevalent in Austrian public affairs. People I knew well, socially, devoted all their strength and efforts to the debates between the various nationalities in Austria. Others were occupied with social matters. Still others worked toward rejuvenating the arts. While I lived in the spiritual world with my soul, I often had the sense that all those endeavors would certainly not be fruitful, because they failed to account for the spiritual forces of existence. It seemed to me that it was necessary, first of all, to consider the spiritual forces, but no clear consciousness of this appeared in the culture around me. Robert Himmerling's epic satire Homunculus was published then. It held a mirror to contemporary life that intentionally caricatured materialism and the prevailing interest in the superficiality of life. Himmerling depicted men living only in materialistic, mechanistic ideas and activities, who unite with women living strictly within a fantasy world. Himmerling intended to show these two extremes that distort our civilization. Human beings, on the one hand, are heedless of the spirit in their efforts, treat the world as a mechanism, and attempt to arrange life accordingly. On the other hand, people live in soulless fantasies, unconcerned about whether this false spiritual life bears any relationship to reality. Himmerling's exaggerated images of modern life repelled many who admired him because of his earlier works. Even at Della Grazie's, where Himmerling had been admired without reserve, this epic created some doubt. Nevertheless, Homunculus left a deep impression on me. To me, it seemed to depict the spirit-darkening forces active in modern civilization. I found it to be a serious warning for our time. Yet I, too, found it difficult to assess Himmerling. Initially, the publication of Homunculus increased this difficulty. To me, Himmerling was himself a person who, in a peculiar way, symbolized the time. I looked back to a time when Goethe and those around him had lifted idealism to a height worthy of the human being. I saw the necessity of going through the portal of that idealism to the real world of spirit. To me, idealism was like a sublime shadow, sent into the human soul not by the physical, but by the spiritual world, falling into the inner human being and challenging each to reach for the world that casts that shadow. I loved Himmerling's powerful description of idealism's shadow, but it seemed like a great deficiency that he did not take it further. He was less interested in breaking through to a new form of spiritual reality than he was in the shadows of spirituality shattered by materialism. Nevertheless, Homunculus appealed to me. Although it failed to show how to penetrate the spiritual world, it did show the destination of those trying to live in a world devoid of spirit. While I was engaged with Homunculus, I also considered the true nature of art and beauty. and what passed through my soul was reproduced later as the brochure, quote, Goethe as the Father of a New Aesthetic, unquote, the written version of a lecture I gave at the Goethe Society in Vienna. I wanted to discover what was preventing the idealism so urgently conveyed in the philosophies of Fichte and Hegel from understanding living spirit. In my search for the cause, I reflected on the errors of the purely idealistic philosophy of aesthetics. The opinion of Hegel and the Hegelians was that the meaning of art is found in the ideas presented to the senses. In other words, embodied in a physical medium, an idea manifests as beauty. But the age following that of idealism no longer wished to acknowledge the reality of ideas. Because the idea, as it lived in idealistic philosophy, could not point to a spiritual world, the succeeding age was unable to maintain the intrinsic reality of ideas. This led to a quote-unquote realistic aesthetic that in terms of art was unconcerned with the idea embodied by physical form. It concerned itself only with the physical image itself, which, because of the needs of human nature, assumed an unreal form in art. In my view, the sensory aspect should be the important aspect in a work of art. Nevertheless, I recognize that the path of the true artist is a path to the true spirit. One begins with what is physically perceptible, but then transforms it. And what guides the artist is not a mere subjective impulse. Rather, one tries to impart to the senses a form that appears as though the spirit itself were visible. I told myself that beauty is not an idea that is given sensory form, but a presentation to the senses in the form of spirit. Consequently, I viewed art as a way of placing the spirit realm into the sensory realm. A true artist affirms the spirit more or less unconsciously. I told myself repeatedly that it is necessary only to transform the soul forces with which the artist works upon physical materials into extrasensory, purely spiritual perception, so that one may penetrate real knowledge of the spiritual world. I became aware of the interrelationship between true knowledge, spirit manifested in art, and moral will in the human being. I saw in the human personality the center where the human being unites with the utmost primordial being of the world. From that center springs the will, and when the clear light of spirit is active in that center, the will is free. The human being thus acts in harmony with the spiritual nature of the world, which becomes creative not because it must, but purely to fulfill its own being. In this center of the human being, goals of action are born, not from obscure impulses, but from quote-unquote moral intuitions, as transparent as the clearest thought. Consequently, in contemplating free will, I attempted to discover the spirit that makes a human being individual. In the feeling for true beauty, I attempted to witness the spirit that acts through human beings whenever they act in such a way that not only do they express their own being spiritually as a free act, but their spiritual being also flows into the sensory world, which, although coming from the spirit, does not reveal it directly. By comprehending the truth directly, I tried to experience the spirit that reveals itself through its own being, and whose reflection spiritually is a moral act, which is the goal of an artist when creating a form perceptible to the senses. A philosophy of freedom was forming within me, a life view of the thirst for spirit, of the sensory world striving toward beauty, a spiritual vision of the world of living truth. The end of chapter 21. Chapter 22. In 1888, I was also introduced into the household of evangelical pastor Alfred Formy in Vienna. Each week, a group of artists and writers gathered at his home. Alfred Formy was himself a poet. His close friend, Fritz Lemmermeier, characterized him this way, quote, Alfred Formy writes in mellow, effervescent harmonies. He is warm-hearted and enthusiastic, has a deep sense for nature, and is almost drunk with faith in God and blessedness. It is as though he does not walk on solid earth, but sleeps and dreams high above in the clouds. Unquote. This also describes Alfred Formy as a person. One felt swept into another realm when at first only the minister and his wife were there. The pastor had a childlike piety. His great warmth of heart made it natural for him to get into a lyrical mood. He needed to say only a few words to create a friendly atmosphere. His wife had traded the stage for a rectory. One could not detect the former actress and the pastor's affable wife, who entertained her guests with such delightful charm. She looked after the pastor almost like a mother. Motherly care was expressed in almost every word she spoke to him. In both of them there was an enchanting contrast between inner charm and outer dignity. Guests brought the world from all spiritual directions into that unworldly rectory. Friedrich Hebbel's widow occasionally came, and her presence always made it festive. She had developed in her old age an art of recitation that was enchanting and artistically captivating, and her narration filled the whole room with warmth. At these formy evenings I also became acquainted with the actress Frau Wilborn, an interesting person with a wonderful voice for recitation. It was always a pleasure to hear her render Lanau's Three Gypsies. Soon the formy group began to meet occasionally at Frau Wilborn's as well, and what a difference! Those who were always serious at the rectory, even when the Viennese folk poet Friedrich Schlegel read his amusing quips, would joke, filled with joie de vivre. For example, when cremation had been introduced recently in Vienna, Schlegel wrote a short literary composition about a man who loved his wife in a somewhat coarse way, and whenever something displeased him, he always shouted at her, quote, "Get burned, old woman," unquote. At Formy's, such instances evoked comments that were a kind of comment on the cultural history of Vienna. Whereas at Frau Wilborn's, people laughed until the chairs shook. At Frau Wilborn's, Formy gave the impression of being worldly. At Formy's, Frau Wilborn gave the impression of an abbess. One could study human transformation in detail, even the changes in facial expression. One of those who usually came to Formy's was Emily Mattia, who, under the pen name of Emile Marriott, wrote novels that were penetrating observations of life. She was a fascinating person, who through her way of life revealed the hardships of human existence in a vivid, original, and often provocative style. She was an artist who understood how to portray life where it casts its mystery into everyday life, where it flings crushing blows of destiny on human beings. Often at Formy's we were able to hear the artists of the Austrian Cempas Women's Quartet, and we repeatedly heard Fritz Lemmermeier recite Hebbel's Heidegneben melodramatically to fiery piano accompaniment by Alfred Strauss. I loved that rectory, where one could find so much warmth. The effect there was of the noblest in humanity. Also during that time I had to concern myself with the details of Austrian public affairs. This came about when for a short time in 1888 I was editor of the German Weekly Review. It had been established by Friedjung, an historian. My brief term as editor coincided with a time when the conflict between the various peoples of Austria was becoming especially vehement, and I found it difficult to write articles every week on public events. Essentially, I kept as far as possible from partisan politics. What interested me was the evolution of culture in humanity's development. I had to present responses to this, so that, while doing it full justice, my articles did not seem to be written by an unworldly idealist. In addition to this, I recognized a particular obstacle to cultural interests in the education reform introduced in Austria by Minister Gauch. At one point my comments caused some doubts even in Schröer, who was always sympathetic to partisan concerns. In contrast to the pedagogically unsound measures of Gauch, I praised the more appropriate measures introduced into the Austrian gymnasium curriculum in the 1850s by the Catholic clerical secretary Leo Thun. When Schröer read my article, he said, quote, "Do you then want a return to church-controlled education in Austria?" Unquote. My brief stint as editor was nonetheless very significant to me. It directed my attention toward the current way of dealing with Austrian public affairs, though I was strongly averse to this style. I wanted to introduce something into the discussion of public affairs that had an impulse toward the great spiritual goals of humanity. I searched in vain for it in contemporary journalism. I was concerned daily with making such an impulse effective, and it became a serious concern because I lacked the strength that might have been provided by rich experience in this area. In fact, I was completely unprepared when I became editor. I believed I would be able to recognize the necessary course in the various areas, but I lacked any sense of how to formulate such things clearly for my readers. Consequently, it was a real struggle for me to come out with a new issue each week. It felt as though a huge burden had been lifted when this work ended, because the paper's owner became involved in a controversy over the purchase price with its founder. This work, however, did allow me rather close contact with those who were active in a wide variety of branches of public life. I became acquainted with Viktor Adler, the undisputed leader of the Austrian Socialist Party. That slender, unassuming man concealed an energetic will. As we talked over a cup of coffee, I always sensed that what he had to say was unimportant and commonplace, but that the way he spoke revealed an unbending will. I came to know Pernerstörfer, who was in the process of changing over from the German Nationalist Party to the Socialist Party. He was a strong individual with comprehensive knowledge and a sharp critic of the defects in public life. He also published a monthly magazine, Deutsche Worte, which I found stimulating. Along with these individuals, I met others who wanted to validate socialism, scientifically or according to the party. My acquaintance with them led me to study, among others, the social-economic writings of Karl Marx, Friedrich Engels, Rodbertus. I found it impossible to find any inner relationship to all this. To me it was personally painful to hear it said that it is the material economic forces in human history that carry true evolution, whereas the spiritual element is merely an idealistic structural extension of that quote-unquote true foundation. I knew the reality of the spirit, and to me socialist theories constituted a willful blindness to the real truth. Nevertheless, I saw clearly the immense importance of the social question. It seemed to me that the tragedy of the age was that those who were concerned with this question were also steeped in the materialistic views of contemporary civilization. It was my view that this question could be formulated correctly only by a worldview in harmony with spirit. Thus, at the age of 27, I was full of questions and mysteries about external human life. At the same time, the nature of the human soul and its relation to the spiritual world confronted my inner perception in an increasingly definite and self-contained way. I was able to work spiritually only through such perception, and a few years later this work led me more and more to write my title Intuitive Thinking as a Spiritual Path, A Philosophy of Freedom, German title Die Philosophie der Freiheit. The end of chapter 22 and the end of this section of the reading.